Additional encore audio archive recordings are available at www.12steptapes.com. We request you not upload this recording to the major free outlets. We are happy to allow free listening on our own site with a subscription service. Contact us on www.12steptapes.com for more information.
4 years.
But I'm no judge, no win.
I'm Mike, and I'm an alcoholic. I haven't spoken in front of this many people, so you'll have to bear with me. Let's see here. I'll try to keep it within the length, the customary length of a speaker meeting. My late uncle used to say when I was a little kid that I had diarrhea of the mouth, which he called verborrhea. So I guess I'll start here. About 34 years ago, I was in Washington, D.C., suburban Maryland, and I was in a military school at Bethesda Naval Hospital, and I had was having a little problem with emotions. And I had already started talking to a Navy shrink. And of course, I never told him about my drinking, which now was becoming more and more frequent. And I was now getting to the point where I would drink to try to get a buzz, but not to black out or pass out, but I couldn't control how much the amount I needed. I couldn't titrate it well enough, to use a scientific word. So I was drinking 151, Jägermeister, and just because I couldn't really get drunk anymore, I would just drink and then wake up hungover and sick, but I didn't remember the buzz. So sometimes I would even set my alarm, like I'd estimate how long it'll take to get to feel it, and then I'll wake up and I won't miss the buzz stage. Needless to say, that's a very difficult thing to do if you're an alcoholic. In addition to trying to, a couple months before that, I did an experiment that had to do with gravity. We tried that in fraternity in college in San Diego. It's called a beer bong. But so I was now also to the point where I needed to get some booze at lunch. Now, mind you, it's kind of a formal military school, and I'm wearing an officer uniform, and I had a Honda Accord hatchback. Now, those hatchbacks have the seats in the back that fold down, so you could actually almost sleep in or pass out in the back. So I'm down there, and it's lunch, this is 1989, and this is it's like a parking garage underneath this building, and there's a lot of these guys and gals that served in Vietnam and were in MASH hospitals and really. So some of these people are walking through this parking garage with briefcases and uniforms, and I've got the thing pulled over so you can't see what's in the trunk, and the seats are down, and I've got a bottle, and I'm trying to drink it without popping my head up, because if one of these guys sees me, you know, I mean, he's going to call the police, and they're gonna find me in my car. And I just want to report to you, you cannot drink horizontally. I mean, you it doesn't work. You have to have a little gravity for it to go down. So I just want to start off with that, because a very good sponsor I had who passed away in San Diego with 36 years of sobriety in 2014, his name was Frank D. And he had been in the military. He'd been also in healthcare. He used to say, you know, when he first got here, He was not a quick study. And on my report cards at parochial school, they never said Mike catches on quick. I don't think any of my friends believe that either, too. So, but anyways, you know, I had started drinking in the late 70s. I was raised in an intact family, not a perfect family. I now realize after several years of sobriety that there is no perfect family, and that our parents are doing the best they can with what they had, with what their parents who were doing the best they can had. So, the only reason I can think I drank, the reason was I was curious. I saw some of my friends, some of the more sophisticated people in our junior high class who had started, you know, cigarettes, dip, chew, pot, booze. And, you know, we called it partying. And, you know, I was an insecure kid. I was not held back. So I was on the young. I'm born in September, so I was not going to be a rocket star in sports. Not just because of that reason, but but I was always the younger kid. So, you know, in parochial school, I got in trouble, but it's usually because I was trying to. I was associated with the more deviant mindsets, most of whom are my best friends. I started nipping booze, and I tried. I heard about what my friends were doing, but I would sneak it out of the liquor cabinet. Now all the track houses and in the 70s, you know, I guess that's maybe the 60s. They started building bars into houses. I don't think that happened. That doesn't happen much now. So, you know, I would do the liquor cabinet thing and pour the water in to make sure the levels, like I was fooling anybody. But I was just curious, and I would sneak the stuff, and there were fig orchards still in a lot of the tracks in our town here. So I'd go out, you know, in the figs and smoke a cigarette, put some chew in, and try to drink this stuff they said makes you feel good. And, you know, I never really did it enough to feel something until there was one day a friend of mine, Ray Ann B., and she's not here tonight, but she's got long-term sobriety, great gal. She was out there with her friends, and I was trying to get attention, and I finally had a buzz. And I was trying to show off my basketball skills, which is kind of hard at 5'1". And I broke my left wrist. And I was like 5 years sober before I realized that was the only time in my life I've ever had a cast on. So if you're here and you stick around, memories will come back. Not always good ones. But this is definitely the place to have that happen. So, and then a couple weeks. Oh, and by the way, I was a freshman at San Joaquin, and I wanted to play JV baseball. Now they weren't looking for me to try out with a normal wrist, and I'm right-handed. So, you know, I wasn't gonna make the team with, you know, putting a glove over your cast and. Imagine trying to hit the ball. So I got cut, but like a week later, my mom took my brother and sister out for, they had a bunch of appointments, and so I don't know if my dad was in town, but I got enough booze to really get that feeling. And I drank a lot, and I got that feeling that booze does, you know, if you're an alcoholic, it does something for you that it does not, or it does something for me that it does not do to a normal social or even heavy drinker. And I got that feeling that now I know what people were chasing. Now, I didn't last long, and I blacked out, and I vomited all over the house, and my brother had to pull my mattress out onto the back deck and hose it off. I was deathly ill, And you know, I was in trouble. I was grounded. And the next day, I think the basketball NCAAs were playing, and I felt so horrible. But you know, I had found out what this is all about, and I was determined to do that again. And so I crossed the line. You know, I started drinking. You know, I didn't have a social drinking phase. And you know, and I've had sponsors since that, you know, raised kids, sent them off to college, retired from the military or corporation or teaching, and then became alcoholics. Maybe they were heavy drinkers. So we, you know, who knows how we get here? We all have our roads, but we end up here hopefully. So you know, after that, I wanted to fit in high school, and all of us did. Now I think all kids want to do that, and we started the walk parties, going up to liquor stores and hitting people up who were buying booze to buy it for us, and we're pretty successful doing that, you know. And so the drinking started, and then you know I was always kind of afraid to drink heavily out in public, because I did know, you know, that I don't remember where they found me, my parents. On that first real drunk, so I was always a little cautious, and but I would end up also drinking late when I got home, late at night on a weekend, stay up, I'd stash booze, and you know, right around that time, parallel to that, I started having problems with anxiety and depression. Now I don't know which caused which, but again, that was another revelation that I had when I was sober. So, you know, alcoholism, I would say psych illnesses, you know, the people in this room have a much higher percentage of psych illnesses as maybe the people who are going to be watching the U.S. Open in New York next week. Maybe not. They have more money, so, and sometimes that can be more of a curse than a blessing, especially in these rooms. I made it through high school. I still had good friends, and a lot of us drank a lot, and miraculously we didn't get into too much trouble. A lot of us had some really close calls, but you know, I liked the camaraderie of drinking, and but you know, I still had that anxiety and not fitting in, I had a goal. I wanted to do a profession, and so I went off to school in San Diego, and you know, continue to do the drinking and have the anxiety and the drive for success. You know, I like reading Bill's story, and then James Woods really plays Bill Wilson just perfect in that movie. My name is Bill W. You know, somehow I made it through college. And I actually got into this program in the military, and it's kind of funny because you'd think the military would be more restrictive, but you know, I was a reserve officer in training, and you know, I had a little salary and a roommate, and you know, he drank too. He drank socially. You know, and there's people that drink socially, and they can drink heavy. And you know, I had a lot of friends in high school and college that they drank. They were crazy in high school and college, but they grew out of it. That's the difference between the alcoholic like me is we don't grow out of it. We're not capable of it. You know, and I remember when I first got sober, I heard something in treatment that, you know, the purpose of adolescence is to go from child to adult, and you need to master some developmental milestones, meaning you need to learn how to grow the fuck up. And if you start using alcohol to get away from the pain that process entails, you are not going to grow up. So you will be a person prone to temper tantrums like a four-year-old, at age 31. That's not a good thing. I don't know. Not something to aspire for. But, you know, and so, you know, I started drinking, and I just couldn't stop drinking, even though good things continued to happen in my life. And, you know, at that time, I remember I would call my aunt or uncle and drive them crazy, you know, self-pity. And they told me, you know, you don't know how good you have it. And, you know, when I look back, even before I got here, I still had it pretty good. You know, the bottom was raised up to me, thank God. You know, I didn't dabble too much in the other substances because I really didn't trust myself in public. And, you know, when I had my 21st birthday, that was the other time. That's the only other time I've had stitches on my body other than, you know, elective surgery. They took me out all over town for my 21st birthday. And, you know, I guess finally at the last restaurant, I didn't come out of the bathroom. So one of my friends had to go in there and or go over and unhook the thing because I was passed out over the toilet. And then they drove me around town and dragged me out so I'd puke on the side of the road. But they got me home and they tucked me in bed, which, you know, you can't, that's safe. But I got out of bed in the middle of the night and I dropped a glass on my foot trying to get a glass of water or a drink. But again, that's the only time I had stitches outside of elective surgery. So, anyways, by the time that summer of 89 came, I was really having trouble now at work. And I, you know, we're alcoholics. I always think that I'm pulling a fast one. I'm hiding it. I'm not going to let it. You know, what I wanted to do, because I thought I saw these people in high school and college who could drink and party. You know, I knew a guy. There was a guy in my fraternity in San Diego. He was dealing cocaine to pay for his tuition and his house in Del Mar on the cliffs. And, you know, so they say drinks that they see people taking with impunity. My sponsors were big on dictionaries, and impunity means, you know, without consequences. So I wanted to just drink as much as I wanted to, you know, have everything be great in life, money, you know, relationships, prestige and respect from the people I looked up to. But, you know, I had this, it's like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. It's like a split personality. That's what I thought it was. And so anyways, I was really struggling, and I ended up catching chicken pox. I never got chicken pox when I was supposed to as a kid. So I got chicken pox at age 23. And of course, I just stayed home and drank. And, you know, in the military, that's not a smart thing to do. You can get away with a lot until you screw up, and then you get under the spotlight, and you're never getting out from under it. So they basically did an intervention on me. And, you know, I ended up in an office with an Army doctor who was sober. He'd been through Alcoholics Anonymous and rehab. And he took me to my first AA meeting on August 25th, 1989. And, you know, I had heard about AA from one of my best friend's fathers. And I actually called him a year before. It's kind of funny. I woke him up because it was 4 in the morning in Bethesda. And one in the morning here in California, and I'm sure his wife didn't like that. But I woke him up, and he took the time to talk to me, and he was sober long. He died with long-term sobriety. And he talked to me, and I don't really remember what he said because I was drunk. But you know, when I was getting sober a year after that, he was there for me. So, you know, even if we're ordered in here by for a DWI or, you know, the seed gets planted. So anyways, they still had, they had not closed all the military bases, so they still had Naval Hospital Long Beach was open, and they made an arrangement for me to take a leave of absence from the school and go out to Long Beach for rehab. And, you know, And I went to meetings that first weekend, and I thought, oh, I'll just be off at home working out, going to meetings, and that wasn't the way it was going to go down in the military. I got called in, and they put me in front of a shrink who looked like Count Dracula, New York Italian guy. And he said, well, yeah, you're an alcoholic, but we're also going to lock you up on the psych ward on the way out there because we don't trust you. You know, you say you're going to work out, but we don't believe you. And so I ended up getting escorted in my little white Navy uniform to the psych ward at Bethesda Naval Hospital. It was the old building, probably they built it in World War II. It was called NP6, and it was on the sixth floor, and there were some of my classmates there working, you know, learning mental health, and they saw me walk in there, and you know, I was kind of in custody, and I had to go into the bathroom, and you know, I had to pee in a cup, and I had to put baby blue pajamas on and green foam slippers, and I said, "What about my toothbrush and all?" They said, "Oh, your roommates, they'll bring that. Don't worry." You know, I couldn't do, wasn't allowed to have a razor, and that was the old psych hospital. That's the way they did things. And you know, it's kind of funny because since then I've worked in mental health settings, more acute care, but even those places are not as nice and clean and safe as that place was. You know, that's 34 years ago. So that's another incentive to stay sober if you're an alcoholic, because you don't want to deal with the mental health system today. Again, even with insurance. So, you know, it was old, but it was clean and safe. And so, anyways, they flew us out to rehab in Long Beach, and I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. That was a good treatment center. They took us to meetings, sometimes twice a day, and you know, I started to listen to people share, and I had this delusion that I was the only person that drank the way I drank because I had this split personality, and that's not true. I heard people share in meetings who were, they were, it's like they downloaded my tapes in my head about why they drank and you know, how it made them feel. And so I started to catch on, and I got out, and then I came back to Fresno, and I got about 10 days of vacation on the way going back east, leave. And I met some old timers here, my friend's dad and another good friend's father who passed away with long-term sobriety. And they took me to meetings, and you know, I ran into some other classmates, parents in meetings, and brothers and sisters. And it was pretty cool. So I was okay going to meetings, and you know, I was okay saying the Lord's Prayer because I'd never heard the Serenity Prayer, and that was pretty good. But I grew up saying the Lord's Prayer, you know, five times a day at school and at home. But you know, I was sober, and I was, you know, I'll say, you know, one of the things that happened early on is something was cemented in my head that if I drink or use anything, you know, chemically again, it's going to be worse than a clean psych ward. And to me, that's a gift. Because I just, you know, that pitiful bottom, you know, and bottoms, you know, if I choose, I can go have a lower bottom. I don't want to do that today. You know, I don't think people on the street were born on the street. You know, maybe in third world countries, you know, a lot of those people were functioning citizens. But that's where this alcoholism and the other addictions take us. So I started going to meetings. They made us take Anabuse. I don't know if anyone remembers Anabuse. You know, I met guys in rehab that could drink through Anabuse. You know, that's alcoholics. When there's a will, there's a way. I mean, And fraternity brothers who'd be bombed, you know, were what was it, playing quarters, and they'd have a chew in and they'd vomit and they'd come back and drink more. And you know, if you're an alcoholic, you understand that. You know, and most of alcoholics laugh at stuff like that in meetings because normal people don't do that shit. And you know, how many times have you been in a meeting and you hear a story? Oh, I never tried that. You know, and fortunately, the times I tried other stuff, it helped me get over a hangover. You know, alcohol was my drug of choice. The other stuff I couldn't control, so fortunately, I didn't dabble in that too much. You know, I started going to meetings. I had to do a court card for a year, and you know, by the time you know, I'd found meetings that I liked, and it was a nice area of suburb outside D.C. And I went to meetings when I came home on leave, so it was. I felt that if I kept going to meetings, things are going to be okay, because I didn't want to be locked up again. That's not fun. And I know people, you know, who have had far worse experiences. But if you come here, it gets better. So, you know, I just started doing things, and, you know, I got a lot of support from family and friends. Some people were surprised because I was a real big closet drinker, because I just didn't trust myself in public. And, you know, I'm lucky I didn't get my jaw broken after some of the stuff I said when I was drunk, but you don't remember. So, you know, I just started living life, and I was happy to be sober, and I wasn't the best student, but I finished, and I only finished because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I tried doing a fourth step. I got that Hazelden book, and you know, and then I didn't trust the sponsor I had at the time because I thought he'd throw me out of AA. You know, I thought I was so screwed up. Not that I wasn't, but I there was an AA priest at one of our meetings, and he's sober like 30 years, and I just had a long talk with him, and that helped at that time. And you know, I went to meet, there were some good stag meetings there, and there were people, there was a big speaker meeting on Sunday nights in Potomac, Maryland, which is a really nice part of D.C. And these people were all happy. And I heard stories there, men and women, you know, people from all over the country, and they had crazy experiences, you know, bad bottoms. But they were there happy to be sober, and that really helped me, seeing people who were happy not drinking. Because, you know, there's a chapter in the book, in the back, there's a section called Freedom from Bondage. I love that story. It's written by a lady, and she talks about learning how to live content and happy without wanting to drink. Because if I'm walking around, you know, saying, oh, I wish I could get drunk, I mean, just shoot your, you know, go drink. That's what those old guys they said. You know, they said, go drink. Maybe you have to go drink more. And, you know, I I'm grateful. And I didn't have that too bad. I was anemic. I was having liver problems. It's amazing how we just blow that stuff off. So I ended up getting assigned out to, you know, I finished and got orders to San Diego, and I had a really tough job out there the first year of my training, and it was. But you know, I always managed to get a meeting in on a day or a night off, and I stayed involved with service, and I had a sponsor, and I talked to him, and again, you know, I didn't finish at the top of the class. A couple of months were really bad because, you know, I was expected to recall the stuff I was supposed to be learning when I was drunk. So that didn't work so well. But, you know, my sponsor said, just if they need to flunk you and have you repeat a year, that's what you got to do. You know, it's not my job's to suit up and show up. And you know, finally he helped me do an inventory, and it's basically a list of all the people you're angry at or bitter at. And if you're an alcoholic, that's just about everyone you've ever known, you know, to some degree. You know, and if you do that thoroughly, you got a list of amends already. So that helped. And, you know, he just said, do one name a night. Because, you know, and it's funny because when I looked at that list after I sat down with him, I said, most of these people haven't thought of me and will never think of me again. You know, we put that stuff in our heads. And you know, the thing is, after that, I got another glimpse of grace. I realized I'm not a victim. You know, that all these people were not out to get me. You know, some of these people are very good friends of mine, and some of these people really, really helped me out a couple years ago when I was really sick, physically. So, I started my time in the service, and it's interesting because I got to do things outside of AA that I was everything that I was looking for in life in a bottle, I've actually ended up getting it in sobriety. And that's a miracle. And you know, it's so funny because I had another sponsor, Mike W. He was a banker, accountant guy in Orange County. He passed away too, like hilarious. And he would say an alcoholic is like someone, you know, we do the exact opposite of what we want. You know, you say, you know, someone the alcoholic mindset says, you know, I don't feel good, or you know, and I want to lose weight, but they'll stay home and sit in a closet eating. You know, we don't get it. And little by little, I learned to do things here just a little bit at a time, because I always wanted to do the big things. You know, I remember I was in grade school and people got trophies, and I think, why didn't I get a trophy? Well, you didn't do anything to get it. You know, I mean, you know, well, why didn't I make the basketball team? Well, some of the kids are practicing every day after school. Were you? No. You know, those are revelations for alcoholics, for immature personalities. I mean, it's a shock. You know, I remember I told my sponsor, Frank, you know, I don't feel like going to work. And he said, that's okay, but you can still go to work. You know, I'm not saying physically, you know, having COVID or something, but I learned that I can feel depressed or not under the weather, but I can still do the things that need to be done, and I'll feel better after that. And those are simple things we learn here. You know, I mean, they say it all through the literature. We didn't invent any of the psychological and medical and spiritual principles. Those things have been around a long time. We just kind of streamlined them for emotionally challenged personalities like mine. You know, and all those slogans we hear here, you know, alcoholics don't have relationships, they take hostages. I mean, there's a reason we say stuff like that, because it's true. You know, long-term sobriety is no guarantee of sanity. You know, this is why, you know, it's like we practice this stuff. You know, my friend's son, who's playing in the U.S. Open, he got there because he practices every day, and he makes mistakes. You know, we make mistakes practicing this program. I made a mistake in the late 90s with a great uncle that I loved, and I hurt him, and I was stone cold sober, and I tried to justify it, and you know, we didn't talk for a couple of years, and my sponsor just showed me how to make amends, and when the time was right, you know, we were closer than ever before he passed. So we get to do stuff like we can correct things. You know, that's like what normal self-adjusted people do. You know, I remember I was in training in San Diego, and one of the instructors had said that I was not up to par. Imagine that. And I took it real personally because, you know, alcoholics have real sensitive emotions. You know, where my feelings get hurt easily. And I remember I sat down with the director and he said, you know, that's just one guy's opinion. He goes, I'm not going to graduate you if you can't do the job and you're doing okay. You'll be fine. And so like about 2 months later, I'm working with him on a given day and I mentioned this thing I was still kind of upset about. He looks at me, he goes, like, this is what a normal person does. He goes, you're still dealing with that? I thought we talked. It's like, Mike, what the f-? Just get over it. I mean, alcoholics don't do that. We don't, you know, we hang on. I mean, I've hung on to resentments for 20 years. It's like, let it go. But, you know, it's hard. But that's why we keep coming and we stick together. And it works. So anyways, I was able to go overseas in the service. I went to meetings in other countries, in Europe and Australia and Tokyo and Mexico and, you know, all over the States. And it's amazing meeting people and the stuff you hear and all the experiences. You know, because most alcoholics are pretty interesting people. I mean, they're crazy, but they're interesting, myself included. But, you know, I stayed sober and I kept, you know, every place I went, I made sure I checked in at a meeting. And it always made the trip better, you know, and I didn't get drunk and get in trouble, and I remember what happened, and I have pictures and good memories. You know, and I had those before I got here too, but I didn't appreciate them, and now I do. And that's a little, you know, little miracles. You know, another slogan I love that they say is, don't leave here before the miracle happens. Because, you know, if we had more people that stay here, we'd need to have meetings at Save Mart Center. And how many of you who are going to meetings have had a group conscience to have to get a bigger room? Not me. So, you know, this is still a rough condition, rough disease. And, you know, I think now it's harder. You know, I had a dream within the last week of smoking cannabis and trying to justify why I'm still sober in a dream. I mean, what a trip. It's just, you know, but it shows me how deep addiction, you know, the desire to intoxicate is buried into my subconscious. And that's why I still need to be here. Yeah, I heard another guy say that, you know, the reason I need to do this, you know, people who are here longer, all the more reason that we have to try to do this thing as best as we can, because we got a hell of a lot more to lose. You know, you drink again 4 days sober, you know, not as much of a big deal, but 34 years sober, it's going to be pretty ugly. And I've seen that happen, and I don't like to see that. And some people, it happened to some people I really care about and admire. So, you know, this is not a bad habit like eating a little too much ice cream. You know, I probably had a couple more scoops of chocolate ice cream last night with a cookie. But, you know, that's, you know, it took me 10 years to stop tobacco in all forms after I got sober. And, you know, I'm grateful that people didn't, you know, people in meetings said, just deal with the stuff that's going to kill you first. You know, when someone tells me, oh, I'm going to stop sugar and eat organic, okay, don't do that. start slow. The booze and the dry goods, those are going to kill you first. And also, most of us, you know, when we're in our disease, not only are we hurting ourselves, there's lots of collateral damage. And, you know, and that's why I think, you know, when I wrote some letters to people that I'd hurt, and, you know, some people, they didn't care, you know, they didn't, but I made the amends, and I'm grateful the sponsor told me, don't make amends by yourself. Sit down with a sponsor And my sponsor said, you check with me before you make an amends, or you can find somebody else. Because, you know, I always got hidden motives. You know, there were amends that I thought I didn't need to make, and he said, oh, you need to make those. And ones I said, oh, you don't need, just leave her alone. That's your amends to her. Don't ever call her again. That's your amends to her. And that's true. You know, I was outside a meeting maybe a couple of years ago, and Chris was with me, and there was a guy there, and he was scary, and he said, I got to find her to tell her how much I love her. It's like, dude. You know, just, we're you know, it's scary. And, you know, I can laugh about that today. And, you know, just because I'm sober doesn't mean I'm exempt from, you know, I heard a priest say years ago, the potholes of life. You know, I'm convinced, you know, I'm not a spiritual giant. I have learned that the spirituality is the same as emotional maturity. And that if, you know, I'm able to appreciate painful periods of life in retrospect. I can't do it when I'm in it. Maybe you can, but that, you know. But at least I can do it because I know if I stick around here, it's going to be okay. I was given that little faith before I got here, and I've had trouble at times with a higher power, but, you know, I remember I used to, in early, like 7 years sober, a lot of emotional turmoil. I think it's just, you know, I used to try to convince sponsors that God was like up there creating a cosmic conspiracy to make me miserable. And the miracle is I don't try to convince sponsors of that as much. You know, that's an awakening. And I remember I told this one guy, Jim, and Jim had been just a crazy Special Forces Marine. You know, he was smuggling drugs over the Mexican border after he came back from Vietnam. This guy was just amazing. But he said, Mike, I don't mean to burst your bubble, but the God, the higher power that I believe in is too busy creating sunsets and expanding galaxies to waste his time on trying to make you miserable. You know, and I believe that now. You know, and early in my sobriety, there was a old guy named Hal M. back in D.C. and Virginia, and he used to talk about the attitude of gratitude. And I was just like 2 weeks out of rehab, and I'm thinking, this dude is nuts. He's happy, he's grateful, he's an alcoholic. And I ended up getting to know that man, and it's amazing. He wrote that Daily Reflections book. He wrote the passage on February 24th, and he talks about attitude of gratitude and a thankful heart. And then a couple years ago, I looked him up to find his obituary. He passed away sober on February 24th. Yeah. So, I go to this meeting when I'm not working on that day. On Wednesday at noon, we talk about spiritual experience, that section in the back of the book. And I remember an old-timer early on I got to meet up in the Bay Area, and he said, a coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous. You know, and that's pretty cool. You know, that's how my awakening has happened, is these little coincidences that not only happen in my life, but in other people's lives. And because I'm trying, not very well some days, I can be happy for other people's success. You know, because, you know, when I was getting drunk, I wasn't getting drunk to make you feel better. You know, I wasn't getting drunk for, it's such an inherently selfish act. You know, and that's why, you know, people don't feel sorry for alcoholics the way they feel sorry for cancer patients or someone or a poor kid with leukemia. But that's the way it is. So, you know, it's a miracle that we have some of these insights. And these things happen, you know, they don't happen if I pray for them. They just happen. You know, the aha moments, they call. And that's now I'm sober, I can experience them the more. You know, they were happening before, but, you know, when you're, the reason I drank was to cloud my consciousness. You know, and I don't know why, it just worked. It felt better. And, you know, I still trip out. I was listening to a commercial. They're talking about Vivitrol or Naltrexone, which is for withdrawal, and that's okay. But this guy talking about, you know, it may help you drink a little less. You know, why would you want to drink less if you're an alcoholic? That doesn't make sense to me. You know, there was a Catholic church at the back gate in Tokyo, the Navy base, and we get all these guys that went out to sea in the carrier, and they'd come back, and we had this meeting there, and there were guys who were expats working for Toshiba there, so, and we'd make the coffee, and the Japanese meeting was just down the hall, and they'd make the tea, and we get these young guys come in and talking, you know, American ships are dry. British ships, I think they have alcohol on, but American ships are dry, so they'd be out in the Persian Gulf, and you know they're out there for this. This is 2003, 2002, so they're out there for 4 months at a time, and that's not, you know, the aircraft carrier is like a small city, and these guys start to get into big trouble. So they would have. They said halfway through the cruise, they would have a barbecue with beer on the flight deck. And each guy would get a couple beers. It's like, if you're an alcoholic like me, that's torture. I mean, I wouldn't even do it. It's like, I wouldn't even go. Because that's how I drink. I drink to get drunk. You know, and I just know that's the way it is. So anyways, I got out of the service, and when I got out of the service, they wanted me to stay in. And that's nice. That's nice because, you know, if you do these things, you know, you start to fit in a little more. So I came back home and I started working, and you know, I switched jobs from one part of the town to, and at that time I also got, the guy said, I'm sorry to see you go. You know, and so we do that. We can be part of a team. You know, we can, like they say, be a friend with friends, a worker among workers. You know, an uncle, a father, a parent. And because, you know, life happens, and I've started to learn that just because I'm sober, you know, I kind of had this myth when I first got sober. Well, that's my disease, so I'm not going to get anything else. Well, you know, there's a friend of mine in Orange County. He says he repeats a quote. Someone said that you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans. But I also believe that higher power has some. You know, I don't fear that as much anymore, and I can trust more now. And a lot of times, what gets me to that point is having absolutely no power. You know, and I was in a position to. I wanted to stay in the service and go overseas with someone and get married, but my sister was sick, so I came home, and I ended up donating a kidney to her 12 years ago. And I couldn't have, they do, I don't know if anyone's been participating in organ donation, but they screen you. You know, if I was an alcoholic, even though I was a match, they wouldn't let me donate. So, you know, and that's a miracle. And, you know, wasn't in my plan, but, you know, I didn't want to see my sister on dialysis. I wouldn't wish dialysis on anybody. You know, I wouldn't wish going back out into this disease on anybody. You know, that resentment thing they talk about here is real big. You know, I try to practice with some other spiritual books that sponsors have suggested. A lot of us have read them. But, you know, try to wish good things, especially for people I dislike. But, you know, I'm really good at taking other people's inventory, and, you know, and the only people that I heard some guy say, you know, You really want a good inventory, ask their family. Ask their employer. So anyways, you know, I thought that was, you know, patting myself on the back and feeling grateful I got an opportunity to help a loved one. And then a couple years ago, I noticed I was having a little tremor in my left arm. There's a guy from Visalia, Horace. He was in the Navy with me, and he was there teaching nursing students. And he saw me shaking. He said, "Are you drinking again?" He's quite amusing. He's hilarious. But no. And so you know, they said it was pre-Parkinson's, and you know, the only thing I ever wanted to have in common with Michael J. Fox was the money and the name, okay, and the height. But you know, and so I've, again, because of this program, I can follow directions up until it started getting worse a couple years ago. So I explored an alternative remedy. Don't worry, it wasn't marijuana. But I tried kind of a natural form of the medicine, and it didn't work. You know, and I wasn't honest with my physician. You know, and I believe in some alternative remedies, but, you know, just for your information, if you're going to try something, make sure you have the person that's going to have to bail you out sign off on it. And, you know, so what ended up happening is for 6 months, I mean, I the first couple of weeks and 2 months, I couldn't turn over in bed. I was basically trapped in my body. And that's, you know, I have, you know, because I'm in a healing profession, but I had empathy for people with disabilities, but now I really do. And some people, you know, people in this room had to take me to the bathroom. And, you know, they had to restart the meds, and it takes time, and so, because otherwise you get the amazing thing is the meds work, but sometimes they work too well, and then you can't stop moving. So that's a nice roller coaster. But, you know, because of this program, people came, brought meetings to me, because I couldn't even watch one on Zoom. I only had like four an hour and 15 minutes spread out through the day where I could function. And that was, you know, shower, shave, clean clothes, haircut, because if I didn't do that, forget it, just bury me. You know, and you know it's funny because that sponsor, Frank in San Diego, he had a big effect on me. It's pretty funny too. But he told me, you know, I tried the threat, if I don't get my way, you know, I may as well kill myself. And he said, well, you can try to do that, but first of all, you might not succeed. And, you know, and he said, regardless of what you think happens after that, you're going to end up in a space where your problem is going to be a hell of a lot harder to solve. And, you know, that's when I started praying for a willingness to stick with this program. And again, because I've been able to do things in this, I've learned stuff in this program, and I've been able to practice it out in the real world. And, you know, all that stuff was taught to me by my parents, my church, my coaches, my teachers, my friends' parents. But I never used it until I had to. So, anyways, these people took over my house, all my friends, people inside, outside the program, people from work, family members, and they took care of me. And I had to trust them to take me to the bathroom and, you know, wore diapers. You know, I mean, I could see if I'm 90, but 56, not cool. But, you know, I the thought of suicide, you know, I thought I might be able to crawl my way into the pool. But then I realized that all these people that came out to help me, not gonna do it. And I prayed for the strength to stick it through. And all these people, you know, I can never forget them. They're just amazing people. And whatever I think about the world after watching the news, the world is a beautiful place, and people are beautiful. And because, you know, because of that, because of what we, you know, we all of us go through stuff here. And, you know, again,
I've had addiction in my family. I think most of us have, and it just breaks your heart. And you know, and AA is not for everybody. I know people who started in AA and then they got very involved in their church and they're doing okay. You know, it's none of my business to go around saying, "Well, you're not going to meetings." I mean, you know, who am I? Who am I to lecture anybody? And it says in that book is that we don't have a monopoly on recovery. We just have one way that works. And for me, this is the easiest, most least expensive, most available way to do it. I mean, there's other ways to do it, but this thing has been streamlined and is, you know. So, anyways, I think I stayed under an hour. Thanks.